Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Biden arrives in Europe today on his first foreign trip since taking office, though he's already well known around the world as the former vice president and a senator before that. His first stop is the UK for a meeting of the G7, the group of seven wealthy democracies. Then it's on to a NATO summit in Brussels. And the trip will end next Wednesday in Geneva with a one-on-one meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. NPR's Frank Langfitt is in England. And Frank, as you well know, President Biden has so much going on here, the pandemic, his infrastructure bill. What's his mission there?
You know what I think you're going to see first, Robin, is him trying to reestablish U.S. global leadership, repair relationships with these, particularly the European members of the G7, and kind of undo the damage by President Trump to America's standing in the world and these traditional relationships across the Atlantic. There are already signs that actually President Biden is having an impact. There's some polls that show that the U.S. standing in some key G7 countries, the U.K., France, Germany, and Japan, has improved since the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And as to what governments here right now think, I asked Natalie Tocci. She advises the European Union on foreign policy. Are European leaders buying the idea that America is back?
Yes, in general, they are. Of course, there is still the sort of lingering question of back for how long.
And I think what she's getting at there, Robin, is will Trump or a Trumpist Republican win the White House in 2024 and revert to an America First agenda and also return to alienating the country's European allies?
So maybe a little wariness there. Well, the G7 meeting is first. COVID-19 must be top of the list, especially since it's being held in the UK, where Prime Minister Johnson, as you know, is trying to reopen the country, as scientists where you are telling him that this Delta variant of the coronavirus, this vicious strain first seen in India, may launch a third surge. So what is your sense of what's going to be on the agenda?
I think that there will be naturally a big focus on the pandemic. And right now, the United Kingdom is trying to figure out, do they lift all restrictions on June 21st? And daily deaths are actually in low single digits now, so there are some good signs, and there's heavy vaccination here, but there are concerns that we could see a resurgence. I think you'll see people focusing here at the G7 on COVID and climate change. The G7 wants to focus on economic recovery from the pandemic and how to prevent future pandemics, but there are also a lot of people who want the G7, as you were mentioning, these are among the wealthiest countries in the world, to do more right now to help poor ones that are struggling to get and distribute vaccines. Now, President Biden, he's pledged to send 80 million COVID-19 vaccines abroad. The UK says it wants to send vaccines as well, but it's making vaccinating children here the priority. UNICEF, they would like to see G7 countries send 20% of their vaccines abroad in August, where scientists think they would actually do a lot more good. I was talking to a guy named Rob Yates. He's at the Center for Universal Health at Chatham House. It's a London think tank, and this is what he said.
If we can't get our act together to tackle a killer disease taking down the world economy, when we have the powers and commodities at our fingertips to do that, it doesn't bode well for things like climate change.
Yeah, so obviously this is a huge concern, but is challenging or managing China on the G7 agenda?
Well, officially you won't see it anywhere, but there is a phrase, championing our shared values, and that's G7 code for countering Russia and China. The problem for the U.S., though, which wants to counter China, is that European allies have a very mixed view. They recognize China's arrival, but they want to take full advantage of the world's second largest economy in terms of trade and investment. It's also clear that European allies don't want to become part of an anti-China bloc led by the U.S. in some kind of like throwback to the Cold War. So this is a very tricky challenge for President Biden.
Frank, we know President Biden is on to Brussels, NATO, after the G7. Now, you mentioned Trump already and a wariness. We remember when former President Trump criticized the alliance. So does President Biden have some reassurance to do there?
Oh, absolutely. And he's already done that before. He's made a number of statements along these lines, and he's a very traditional person when it comes to American foreign policy. So I think what you will see is a restatement of that, and I think relief in Brussels. That said, NATO faces a lot of interesting challenges. Troops are now in the process of pulling out of Afghanistan after so many years there. And also, NATO always has to adapt. Remember, it was designed for post-World War II Europe. There are now big concerns about cyber attacks. There's also concerns about China. And NATO navies don't really have the ability to necessarily extend all the way out into places like the South China Sea. So as America focuses more on China, NATO also faces challenges of remaining relevant to the United States.
Well, but Frank, you're in the UK. President Biden will be meeting with troops at a Royal Air Force base there, also be meeting with Queen Elizabeth. Why is this such a huge deal? I mean, it is, you know, when a president meets with the Queen. And by the way, not many more will.
No, she's 95 years old. She is the longest serving monarch in the history of this country. And I got to say, the thing about the Queen that's remarkable is there are almost no figures like her on the planet. She has had her ups and downs, certainly with her family, as we've seen particularly recently, but she has endured, and she's a link to the past. She comforted this country during World War II, and then I saw her do it again very effectively during the pandemic. So it's a big deal because there's nobody like her, and she is living history now.
And she represents an alliance. NPR's Frank Langfitt in the UK. Frank, thank you.
Great to talk, Robin.
Well, if your workplace is anything like ours, your bosses are probably still trying to figure out how and when to bring everyone back to the office, especially now that the pandemic is easing in the U.S. and vaccines are widely available. Laura Benshoff of member station WHYY talked to three employers in Philadelphia and found three different strategies.
Everywhere you look in the FMC global headquarters in Philadelphia, there are COVID-19 protective measures, from the temperature checks in the lobby.
And if this says normal, you're good to go.
Normal temperature.
Okay, great.
To the plexiglass sheets rising up from each office cubicle. Ken Gadeka, a VP at FMC, says they're a throwback from the first time the company brought workers back to the office last summer.
And we got use out of them as we started bringing people back until August, we sent people back home again. But yeah, every floor has them, every open workstation you can see there.
Right now, there aren't many people to protect, at least not yet. The company, which makes insecticides, had been allowing workers to return to the office voluntarily in the spring. But by July 12th, everyone will be back. Gadeka says it's better for their culture.
What we miss tremendously and what we want to get back is that sort of interpersonal interactions, the collaboration, the chance meetings in a hallway, the talk over the coffee pot.
But the reality is, even with this orchestrated full return, some work from home is here to stay. FMC is allowing its 600 local employees to apply to a flex program, which would let them work outside the office 2 days a week. That's in line with predictions from the National Bureau of Economic Research that about 20% of workdays going forward won't be at the office. It might be more than that at Kleinbard LLC, a 50-person law firm in downtown Philly. Michael Fratone, a managing partner, says the pandemic just accelerated some trends in his industry.
We historically have given, I think, a good amount of trust and a good amount of leeway to our attorneys.
Some attorneys were already fully remote, and the company is giving flexibility going forward, with some willing to give up their office space in order to stay based at home. Fratone says one common refrain is they just don't want to commute.
People are not anxious to go back to getting on the 640 train, being at their desk, taking the 715 train home, doing that 5 days a week anymore.
Plans to expand their office footprint are now on ice. That's not exactly good news for the city. Office buildings are at only about a quarter of capacity, according to the most recent data from Castle Systems, a security company. The City of Philadelphia and Chamber of Commerce are trying to change that.
Hey, Philly, unless you're planning...
This is from their ad campaign, which casts returning as a civic duty that's needed to bring back jobs from retail to hospitality to food service.
Get vaxxed, get dressed, and get back to all the things you love about Philadelphia.
But this runs into a new reality. It's much harder to take away an employee perk once it exists.
If my staff had it their way, they would never come in. I think they've just been spoiled.
It's a good spoil, says Michael G. Horsey. He's the CEO of his own accounting firm, which represents some heavy hitters in the sports industry.
You know, basketball, football. Cam Newton's a client of ours. DeAndre Hunter just signed with the Atlanta Hawks.
His firm was subleasing office space and has decided to get rid of almost all of it to cut costs. The company will remain pretty much fully remote going forward. Horsey has done well during the pandemic. His small firm of 5 employees will soon expand to 8 or 9. And he says he doesn't believe in measuring his employees' productivity by the amount of hours they work, but by their output.
You know, I just never dug into the concept of working 13 hours a day and you're really productive only 7.
Plus, he likes the flexibility himself.
You know, after I get off the phone with you, I'm going to play some golf.
By the way, Horsey and I talked at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Benshoff.
President Biden's first encounter on his trip abroad was not with a foreign adversary. It was a Brood X cicada, which flew into the president this morning as he was leaving for Europe. A swarm of cicadas also invaded the engine of the plane carrying reporters who are covering the president's first trip abroad and delayed that flight for several hours. None of it seemed to faze the president. He outlined his goals this morning for meetings with NATO allies and Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Strengthening the alliance, make it clear to Putin and to China that Europe and the United States are tight.
While he is abroad, the president will also be calling on senators to try to salvage that infrastructure deal. Let's talk about it all with our political strategist, Bill Press, the Democrat, and Alice Stewart, the Republican. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Peter.
Good to be with you.
Welcome and, from cicada territory.
I was just going to say, I knew if we waited long enough, we'd be able to talk about cicadas and politics in the same breath. And it finally arrived.
There you go.
Bill, seriously, how tough will it be for the president to reset relationships with European allies on this, his first trip abroad as president?
Well, Peter, that certainly is his first priority, and it's extremely important that he do so. Obviously, these are the oldest democracies on the planet. They're our friends. We've been through 2 world wars together and more for over 75 years. But in the last 4 years, those relationships were torn apart. And it's up to the president's job. First job in Europe, of course, is to, as your correspondent said a few minutes ago, to repair those relationships, to undo the damage of the last 4 years. To let them know by his presence that America is back, you can trust us again, we want to work with you on all the common problems that we have, starting with the pandemic. And I think that's extremely important. His second challenge, of course, is to put it to Vladimir Putin. He doesn't trust Putin, doesn't like him, never has. And I think you're going to see a very frank meeting with Putin where he's going to say, look, you got to knock it off. We're not going to put up with this anymore. No more messing around with our elections. No more hacking into our economic system, whether it's meatpacking plants or the electric grid or the pipelines or whatever. This behavior has to change. And if not, there are going to be serious consequences.
Alice, Peter, what do you think?
If I can just say, I just think, you know, to say that America is back doesn't make sense because America never went anywhere. And former President Trump's America First policy was not about America going it alone. It was about putting American policies and our strength at the forefront. And while I will stand by him on policies, certainly the tone and tenor in which he enacted trade tariffs and withdrew from international treaties certainly frustrated our allies across the pond. And there is some need and importance of President Biden to go and make amends. And I will say this, Bill, you can back me up on this. I do believe President Biden's experience and background in the Senate and as vice president has prepared him well with the relationships that he has formed over the years. But my fear is that his idea of going over there to reset relations is going to be nothing more than to announce to the entire world that the USA ATM is back in operation. And we need to make sure this is not just about us being there financially for our allies, but it's about us being together uniting against these important issues, whether it is the COVID vaccine, whether it is terrorism, whether it is election fraud, whether it is climate change. We need to work together, and the U.S. does not need to bear the brunt financially for a lot of these alliances.
Yeah,
Alice,
can,
do you
Peter,
want to hear just real quick, and then I want to follow up with Alice on Vladimir Putin.
I was just going to, if I can, yes, we do have to reset that relationship. I mean, we do have to let them know they can trust us again. Look, we work together with them. Alice says we have to work together. We work together with them on the Paris Climate Accords. Donald Trump ripped it apart day one. We work together with them on the nuclear deal with Iran. Donald Trump ripped it apart day one. So no wonder they're a little nervous about whether they can trust making working something out with the United States and having it stick. That's all I'm saying.
Alice, do you want a shift in tone from President Biden with Vladimir Putin?
I do. Look, Vladimir Putin is a dangerous leader, and what he did with regard to the elections was wrong. And you know, a lot of even Republicans suffered the consequences of that. So I do hope that President Biden lives up to his word when he said that Putin will pay a price for election interference. And I hope he's able to communicate that and deliver that message, and the message is received when they have their meeting together.
I want to ask two questions on a different trip abroad now. Kamala Harris, back from Central America and Mexico, she called it a success, but she did catch a fair amount of heat from both parties for things that she said. Republicans leapt on her for an answer to a question from NBC's Lester Holt about when she'll visit the U.S.-Mexico border to address the surge of migrants. Let's listen.
This whole thing about the border, we've been to the border. We've been to the border.
You haven't been to the border.
I haven't been to Europe. And I mean, I don't understand the point that you're making. I'm not discounting the importance of the border.
Well, I mentioned.
Alice, start with you. Why are Republicans so worried about Kamala Harris going to the border?
Well, why is she so worried about going to the border, Peter? That's the question. She's the, quote, border czar for this administration, and she won't go to the border. Clearly, she
has concerns
about—
I think that's a Republican term. Joe Biden said she needs to address the root causes of migration in Central America, just to be clear.
Look, I 100% agree with what she sees as the root causes. We do need to continue funding to the Northern Triangle to help them economically and to help with the fears people have there with regard to gangs and violence and drugs and sex trafficking and the economics. I completely agree with her going to the Northern Triangle and addressing the root causes. But you cannot do that at the expense of ignoring the crisis at the border. We even have a Democratic Congressman Cuellar from Texas, who has invited her and the president to come down and see firsthand the crisis at the border, and she will not do so. I'm optimistic that she follows through with her word to do so sooner rather than later.
She has since said she will go. Bill, Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez criticized Harris for saying don't come to migrants when she was in Guatemala. The congresswoman said seeking asylum at any U.S. border is a 100% legal method of arrival. I don't think Democrats were expecting an intra-party conflict here with this fight. How do you think Kamala Harris did?
First of all, on that point, I think she said just the right thing, and I'm sure not every single Democrat agrees with her. But the point is, she was very tough, I think, on her trip. Look, there was that awkward soundbite I want to come back to about the border. But she was very tough on her trip. She did issue those words. Don't come to the border, because you're not going to get in. People needed to hear that.
Joe Biden has said that, by the way,
president
several times.
Of Guatemala, he has said that, too. She told the president of Guatemala, listen, we're going to help you clean up things down here, but you have to clean up your own act, and we're not going to ignore the corruption in your government. That was good stuff. She told the president of Mexico, we're going to help you, but you've got to step up to the plate at the southern border and the northern border, and you've got to do more. So I think that was a success. Back to the border for a second. Let me just say this, Peter and Alice. I'm from California, okay? Kamala Harris has been to the border, I don't know how many times, as United States Senator, as Attorney General. Lester Holt was correct. She has not been there as Vice President. But I would say, so what? In California, let me tell you, we have seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of politicians of both parties come to the border with the TV crews in tow. They get their picture taken, they go away, and they do absolutely nothing. You know what we call them? tourists. They don't do anything. So I think we're making much too much of the fact that as vice president, she has not been there yet.
Lots to talk about here, but I want to shift to Joe Manchin very briefly here, a Democrat from West Virginia. He spoke after a meeting yesterday with concerned civil rights leaders because he said he would not support the bill that Democrats are trying to pass. Let's listen.
We had a constructive conversation. I think everybody pretty much knows the importance of what we're doing. And I think I'm very much concerned about our democracy, protecting people's voting rights.
Joe Manchin also said he did not think anyone's position changed in that meeting. He has said he will not budge on the filibuster. He is giving his party quite a few headaches. I want to ask you both quickly, what responsibility does Joe Manchin have now, since he is throwing up these roadblocks, to get something done on a bipartisanship matter? Is it his responsibility now, Bill?
No, it's not totally his responsibility, but I think Joe Manchin, has to stop believing in Santa Claus. How can he continue to trust Mitch McConnell? Mitch McConnell is never going to change. Republicans are never going to compromise. I think Manchin has to realize if he really, really believes in voting rights, he's going to have to support either a fix or killing the filibuster, because otherwise it will never happen. And I would just finally say, Mitch McConnell proved that this week, made a total fool of Joe Manchin. When Manchin says, oh, I won't support the For the People Act, but I'll vote for the John Lewis Act, doesn't he realize Republicans will be filibuster that too? And Mitch McConnell the very next day said, I oppose that too.
Alice, I want to give you the last word.
Sure. Joe Manchin is the living face of shattering the notion of Democrats saying that Republicans are standing in the way of so much progress that needs to get done. And he is representing his constituents in West Virginia. They're not Santa Claus, they're constituents in West Virginia, and he's doing what his constituents want. And the fact that he's the one standing up goes to show it's not just Republicans.
We got to go. Alice Stewart is a Republican strategist. Bill Press, the Democrat. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Peter.
Hey, thanks, Peter.
On NPR's Rough Translation, a civilian and a soldier looking for love.
I tried to use some of my best lines on Alicia. I told her I'd die for her.
She said, I'll die for you. It's like, you're a soldier. You'll die for anyone.
Stories about connection and missed connections. Each week on Homefront, the new season from Rough Translation.
Colonial Pipeline CEO Joseph Blount faces another round of tough questions today on Capitol Hill. The company shut down for 6 days after a ransomware attack last month disrupted gas supplies and prompted panic buying. Blount told lawmakers yesterday that he was deeply sorry, and he defended his decision to pay a ransom of more than $4 million to a criminal group known as DarkSide.
I made the decision to pay, and I made the decision to keep the information about the payment as confidential as possible. It was the hardest decision I've made in my 39 years in the energy industry, and I know how critical our pipeline is to the country, and I put the interests of the country first.
Aaron Gregg of the Washington Post is following the hearings. Aaron, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And why don't you start with the decision to pay the ransom here? Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire was critical of that and of what appeared to be a lack of foresight. Let's listen.
In your planning, did you have a plan for cybersecurity response that included guidance about ransomware?
Senator, specifically, no discussion about ransom and action to ransom.
What else do we hear from lawmakers there about the decision to pay that ransom?
So Blount took a lot of criticism today about this decision to pay the ransom. He said that it was a decision that he made. He saw it as something that was within the purview of a private company, Colonial Pipeline Co., although he did say that he consulted with the FBI and others about whether to do so. Basically, what he said was that he needed to get this pipeline up and running as soon as possible, and he needed to prevent further damage to the U.S. energy system. He said that paying this ransom, while it was, quote, terrible to give all this money to a bunch of criminals, allowed him to get access to a decryption tool that gave him some of the company's data back, as well as certain services that this criminal group DarkSid offers. They basically operate as a almost like a tech company specializing in ransomware. When a victim is hit, they basically offer to pay you a way of getting all that data back.
What about that amazing exchange when Blount basically admitted that his company did not use dual-factor authentication for its sensitive computer systems, but then said, you know, don't worry, the password was really, really complicated. What else did we learn about Colonial Security there?
So I think what we learned is that this is an issue that affected not only Colonial, but I think a lot of companies, maybe even some of the most advanced companies in the world, probably have similar problems. This was an old account that a previous employee had been using, probably had been sitting in an IT manager's to-do list for a long time to deal with it. But it was just, it was there. The only thing protecting it was a single password. It's unclear how the hackers got that password. It appears that it had appeared somewhere else on the internet because the basic problem of people using the same password across multiple devices and accounts. But the fact remains that Colonial did not use a basic tenet of corporate cybersecurity in relation to this. I think it really highlights how, you know, cybersecurity can often sound really advanced and technological, but in this case, it was a matter of almost hygiene in terms of just following basic procedures.
Just very briefly, do you know if we're going to get anything out of these hearings, new laws?
It's a very good question. I'm hearing a lot of talk today about aggressively deterring Russian hacking groups, for example.
Yeah.
It's unclear whether that will actually happen.
Aaron Gregg of The Washington Post, thank you.
I say home ec class, you say the time you sewed a pillowcase to your pants. Oh, wait, that would be our colleague Karen. Producer Emiko had a home ec teacher named Mrs. Housekeeper. Really? Others might be thinking, oh, it was that required class for girls, even though boys take it. You might be stunned to find out that at its outset, home ec was the path for women to science. Its founder, a chemist, the first female admitted to MIT. It was a path for black women as well. Booker T. Washington's wife, Margaret, was a home economist. They were progressives. Back in 1899, they argued for what we'd call STEM education for girls. They originated school lunch. If you work today on consumer safety or design food for astronauts as they did, you are a home economist. And author Danielle Dreilinger says, bring them and home ec back. Two of the biggest sellers in the pandemic were flour and sewing machines. Big problems, childcare, and budgeting. Danielle's heavily researched book is The Secret History of Home Economics. She joins us by Skype. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Do us a favor, and if you could just take a few seconds and chart, as a home economist would, the arc of the history of home economics. I can see one, a home economist with a white lab coat and a pointer. You know, can you just chart the history for us?
So home economics began in the late 19th century. They were trying to bring science into the home so that doing things around the house would be more efficient and more healthful and take less time. And they simultaneously were trying to turn the home, women's traditional sphere, into a range of careers that women would be accepted in because they were tied to the home. So that would be things like hotel management and early childhood education, dietetics, and they succeeded. Tens of thousands of women got jobs in science and industry and education and the government through home economics, and they did amazingly well for a number of decades until things got a little bit more complicated after World War II, and then they had a resurgence as they addressed feminism, second-wave feminism, and embraced second-wave feminism. But then they got smacked in the face by our country's emphasis on hard academics instead of life skills and vocational skills. And they are still around, but they have really been struggling to show their importance.
Well, and part of that problem is that a lot of people who used to be called home economists are now waltzing off and, you know, they're consumer advocates or nutritionists or other things that used to be under the umbrella. But go back to that beginning, because as you say, this was not about keeping the little lady in the kitchen. It was about freeing her. Talk about this thinking of Ellen Swallow Richards, again, the first woman to go to MIT. And I think even today from, you know, your writing, a lot of home economists have a, what would Ellen do? You know, she's so revered. Who was she?
Ellen Swallow Richards was an amazing woman. She was born in the mid-19th century, and she was devoted to what I guess you could now call science in the public interest. She worked on ecology and water quality and public health, and then she turned her attention to helping everyday women in the home. And she saw that there were all these advances scientifically that you could bring into the house. So for instance, she had a vacuum cleaner, an early vacuum cleaner, because she saw that it was more effective at picking up dirt than a broom. She believed in takeout. She didn't think that there was any reason that everybody had to be cooking their own dinner every night. She thought that was incredibly inefficient. But she also thought that the people who were then making the food instead should have good working conditions and good wages.
Right. There was that. And I love the other thread that you weave, which is as America industrializes, these women were invaluable. Every company would hire them to help them have safety regulations, to get their messages out. This is when we have a woman who travels the country telling people in rural areas how electricity works, or hotlines. These were the women who explained newfangled things to consumers. These hotlines with women behind them helped America embrace commerce.
Right, right. So one of the jobs that home economists had was working for companies, and they also working for government, as consumer advocates and marketing people and really customer service. You know, so just to give an example, it wasn't all that long ago that we didn't have stoves with internal thermostats. If you look, read really old recipes, you'll see that they call for a slow oven or a quick oven, right? So once technology improved so that we had ovens that you could turn to 350 degrees Fahrenheit, you had to hire people to rewrite recipes and to write instructions for how to use these new stoves. This opened up just enormous business opportunities. People who wanted to sell products, for instance, like gold medal flour, which created Betty Crocker. Betty Crocker didn't exist, but she had a team of home economists behind her who were writing her scripts, her radio scripts, her instructions, her cookbooks, her notes and letters and her recipes. And she taught women how to cook, or men, really, anybody who is listening, with this promise that if you followed her instructions, everything you did would turn out perfectly and you wouldn't be wasting anything.
Yeah. I mentioned it was an avenue for women of color. Margaret Washington saw it that way. What was her thinking?
Margaret Murray Washington was a truly extraordinary woman who became college educated and a college dean at a time when very few Black women were educated at all. She was born towards the end of the Civil War in Mississippi, ended up becoming head of home economics at Tuskegee, also was married to Booker T. Washington. And she believed, along with all of her college education for college students, that Black families needed home economics to gain economic self-sufficiency and self-respect, and possibly also respect from white people. And she traveled the world. I mean, she met the Queen of England. When she died, the president sent a telegram. She traveled the world talking about the immense value and the moral leadership that Black home economists could wield in their communities.
Yeah. And there were many Black women who followed in her footsteps. But what happened? Because, yes, these were scientists. These were people steeped in family psychology and sociology. These were trained people. But at a certain point, home ec got the reputation for being, you know, to keep women down by making them dress up as Donna Reed, suburban homemakers in little poodle skirts, you know, stirring a cake recipe.
Well, from the start, there's a real tension that I saw between whether home economics was empowering or whether it was repressive, because the women who founded the field and the women who worked in the field all through saw it as empowering. But in order to make the progress that they wanted, they had to work with people, usually men, who saw it as a great thing for girls to learn, especially girls of color, because they were just going to be maids and wives and mothers. And after World War II, you know, there were many forces that were pushing women back into the home and pushing women out of the workforce for men to come back from the war and take those jobs.
Okay, as we said, there's so much here. You start saying everything you know about home economics is wrong, and you close saying, bring back home economics. Literally, bring back the name of the field and the field. How?
States should make it mandatory. And there is precedent for this because, first of all, not only was it mandatory until a few decades ago, but about half the states already require high school students to take personal finance and personal finance as part of home economics. And even today, already more than 3 million public school students are taking home economics every year.
Yeah. Well, you write things like students could learn about the labor problems of Southeast Asian sweatshops and the urban gig economy. This is something young people care about. You know, fast fashion, where do my clothes come from? The science of it is part of home economics. Would it be for boys and girls?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. First of all, Title IX, the law that brought us women's basketball, made it illegal to put girls in home ec and boys in shop. And when I've interviewed middle school boys taking home economics, you know, I've said to them, why are you taking this class? And they've said, it's so much fun. It's so useful. I'm researching what it costs to rent an apartment in the Metro DC area. I'd better finish my degree. And I said, hey, this used to be a class just for girls. And they said, well, that's ridiculous. Everybody needs to know how to do this stuff. And I agree. Yeah.
Danielle Dreilinger, her book is The Secret History of Home Economics, How Trailblazing Women Harness the Power of Home, Change the Way We Live. Danielle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so as we said, home economics is serious business. But home ec class was often hilarious. If you have a memory to share, please tweet it to us at Here and Now.
Set your alarm clock. There's a solar eclipse happening early tomorrow morning. It won't be a total eclipse like the one that captivated the world in 2017. This one's an annular eclipse, when the moon will pass in front of the sun and appear to some lucky viewers on Earth as a giant ring of fire. And you know Kelly Beatty will be watching. He's senior editor of Sky and Telescope. Kelly, always great to talk to you about astronomy. Thanks for joining us.
A pleasure, Peter.
And what is going to happen exactly early Thursday morning with this eclipse?
You know, the moon is going to be passing directly in front of the sun as seen from Earth. Now, ordinarily, we think that will create a total solar eclipse where the sun is completely blotted out. But the moon's actually farther than average from Earth in its orbit. And so it doesn't quite cover the sun, even though it's going right across it. And so for a lucky few that are along the path of this event, what they'll see left in the sky after sunrise is a ring of sun in the sky, or an annulus, which is where the word came from.
And that's why they call it a ring of fire eclipse. So who will see it in its entirety?
This path begins at sunrise in southern Canada, just north of the Great Lakes, moves to the northeast across Hudson Bay, clips the corner of Greenland, heads toward the North Pole and ends up in northern Siberia. That's not exactly, you know, Main Street USA. I did a rough calculation of how many people, weather, you know, allowing, would actually see this annular eclipse. And it's something like 20,000. Not exactly, you know, a mainstream event for us in the United States.
Well, what a bummer. Will anyone here see anything of note?
Oh, yes. So for a large chunk of the Northeast, we can see a partial solar eclipse. And the farther to the north and east you are, the more you'll see. The people who will see anything at all are northeast of a line from, say, North Dakota down through the Carolinas. Mm-hmm. And then from about, oh, I don't know, what you'd consider the Northeast, New York and New England and the sure. Maritimes in Canada – the maximum of the eclipse will occur after sunrise, which is great because for them, up to about 75 or 80% of the sun will be covered. It will be this freaky crescent sun hanging low in the northeast sky after sunrise.
Well, that's pretty cool. So how early will those people have to wake up?
Here in the Boston area, for example, sunrise is at about 5:10. So for the northeast, The sun will rise literally with one point of a crescent, like a shark fin coming up above the horizon. It will be really incredible for people who have an absolutely clear view to their northeast. If trees or buildings are in the way, you know, you need to find someplace better. And then as it rises, the moon will move more and more completely across the sun until about this 80% point at which it will start receding. It's not a quick event. Solar eclipses, like lunar eclipses, actually take about 3 hours from start to finish. And we happen to be catching this one near its climax, at least for those in the Northeast.
Well, it sounds fun, but a lot of people are not going to be able to see it, most likely because of where they live, but also because it's just going to be so darn early in the morning. But I understand you are definitely going to see this, and you've taken great, great pains to figure it out.
Right, Peter. So the prospects, even where it's visible in Canada, are pretty poor. The weather prospects are pretty poor. And so 2 years ago, I started planning to get away from all of that, or actually above all of that, by chartering a Delta commercial jet that will leave Minneapolis, fly over southern Canada, and there'll be about three dozen of us aboard, and we will literally see the annular eclipse from 38,000 feet. It's really the only way to guarantee seeing this annular eclipse, especially so because I didn't know this when I started planning. This was pre-COVID. The Canadian border is still blocked for entry. And so in a lot of ways, this is the only game in town.
And the advice always is, don't look directly at the eclipse.
Don't ever look at the sun directly with your eye. Even at sunrise, when you think it's safe, you know, there's infrared light coming through that can really do a number on your eyes, creating either temporary or permanent damage to your retinas. So, you know, you can go to our website, skyandtelescope.org, not only for advice on where and when and how best to see and maybe even photograph the eclipse, but how to view it safely. One of the cool things I like doing is just taking my fingers and crossing them crisscross and letting the little holes between them cast little images of the sun on like a wall. And that's a great way to see it safely.
Kelly Beattie, senior editor of Sky and Telescope, thank you so much. Good luck on your journey. That was fun.
Thank you very much, Peter.
And cue the music. So what do you think? You're going to be up early enough to see the eclipse 5:07 a.m. tomorrow in Boston.
How else do you get to yoga at 6? But I'm just going to implore to Kelly, take me. Go with him.
Sounds expensive, if you ask me. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.